Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. It's the third week of March. As always, we begin by catching up with those poor sailors of the whale ship Swan, stuck in the ice off the west coast of Greenland in the spring of 1837, 184 years ago. The readings come from the ship's logbook held in the collections of the Caird Library at the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, and was specially transcribed for us for the podcast. The sailors are still in the utmost peril, sometimes beset, sometimes aground, sometimes adrift. They have been trapped now for 6 months. The crew are in increasingly dire conditions. Not only might their ship be crushed by the ice, but they're also susceptible to frostbite, and as time goes on and their food runs out, to scurvy, and then, of course, starvation. So it's a race against time. Will the ship be able to escape before the crew all die? There was no chance of any help from London. There had been impassioned pleas from Hull, Dundee and Aberdeen, but the government refused to mount a rescue attempt. Little did they know it, but the trapped whalers had become a political cause célèbre.
Friday, 10th March. Fore part of the day commences with strong winds, but the ship remains stationary, the gear being hung up by the reef. Latitude by observation 69 degrees by 55 north. Average of the thermometer this day 16 below zero. Monday, the 13th of March. Strong breezes and fine weather, the ship drifting along the island of Disco about 30 miles off. No water to be seen in any direction, it being a solid sheet of ice as far as the eye can reach. Replenish the oil cask as before. Thermometer 20 degrees below zero. Latitude by observation 69 degrees by 50 north. Friday, 17th of March. Light winds and variable the forepart of this day with warmer weather. The ship has drifted 8 miles to the north during the last breeze of wind, and we are once more among the reef of bergs off the north end of Disco. A 285-gallon shake number 53 cut up for fuel this day.
Today we're exploring the history and the machinery of one of the UK's most interesting vessels in the entire British historic fleet, the SS Shieldhall. As you will find out, she's interesting for all sorts of reasons, some of them smelly, but one we have seized upon for all of you maritime engineers out there is the fact that her engine and boilers are an almost exact replica of those that equipped the Titanic, but just in miniature. And to demonstrate how they work, we've made a wonderful animation. You can find this on the Mariner's Mirror podcast YouTube channel. It'll also be on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, wherever you get your social media. So do please check it out. I think it's fabulous. And also, of course, when the time is right, go and check out the Shieldhall and her engines in person. They really are quite wonderful. They evoke a lost age of maritime history powered by steam. Today I shall be talking to the Shieldhall's chief engineer, Graham McKenzie. Here he is. Graham, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Sam, it's a great pleasure.
So tell me about the Shield Hall. She's a wonderful, wonderful ship with such a great history. Tell me a little bit about her.
Well, a little bit's going to be difficult, but I can tell you a lot.
Tell me lots.
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning. The ship was built in 1955, laid down in October 1954, but launched in July 1955. And she was the fourth of the line of the sludge ships built for Glasgow Corporation, and in fact the last of the steamships for the corporation. There did follow two further motor ships, but that's probably outside of this. Shield Hall was originally conceived back in 1950, when the previous ship of the same name, the Shield Hall 1 as it became, was deemed to be life expired, and so they started to pull together a specification, and eventually went out to tender, as was the normal way, mostly to Scottish shipyards, but one or two English ones as well, on the Tyne, and I think Barrow-in-Furness was the other place. And not surprisingly, it was one of the Clyde yards that won the contract. It was Lobnitz of Glasgow, or Renfrew, I should say, because the people in Renfrew often don't think they're in Glasgow. And Lobnitz was the name's not a good old Scottish name, it's a Danish name, but it's about second or third generation, so as far as they were concerned, they were Scots. Lobnitz was a family company, and it eventually became part of the Weirs Group around about the sort of time that Shield Hall was conceived and built. So 1954, as I say, she was laid down. 1955, July 1955, she was launched, and then went into service in October 1955. So you could say from laying down to into service was approximately a year. She went into service on the Monday. The Shield Hall 1, which her predecessor, actually came out of service on the Saturday, and also went to scrap on the Monday. So that's the way things happened in those days. She was built very traditional lines with triple expansion steam engines and Scotch boilers. The boilers were oil-fired, and this was one of the criteria that they put down right at the beginning, that the ship had to be oil-fired, triple expansion steam engines, and then the dimensions of the ship were preordained. And that was more because of the constraints of the berth that she was working from.
I think, Graham, before we go into the details of the engine, let's go back a bit and just to think about why she was built. So it was the Lobnitz company, you talk about the shipyard. That doesn't sound like a very Scottish name. Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, as I said, they were third generation Danes. So the original Lobnitz was a Danish. He came over to the Clyde side to work, and eventually took over the shipyard. And then, as I say, I think the Lobnitz that was owning the yard when the ship was built was actually third generation. But H. Pearson Lobnitz was he was known as Pearson, although that was his second name. I can't remember what his first name was. And that was certainly the yard stayed as Lobnitz right up until the time that the upper and lower Clyde shipbuilding groups were formed in the 1970s. Yeah. But there was sort of mergers that happened. So Lobnitz merged with the yard next door, Simons, and became known as Simon Lobnitz. And in the sort of 50s and 60s, various transitions took place with the whole industry, not just on the Clyde, but in the whole of Great Britain.
Yeah, and what do we know about the Glasgow sludge fleet? I mean, we kind of skimmed over a bit there, but it's a ship that's designed and built for carrying sewage.
Yes. Now, the Glasgow sludge fleet, like many, so London, Southampton, Exeter, Manchester, you could go around the country, most of the big cities and towns had their own sludge ships, which basically took the sewage sludge away from the sewage works, took it out to sea and dumped it. And that happened for a good part of the 20th century, in fact. And it was a convenient way of getting rid of the sludge, which I'm told is only about less than 5% of what goes down into the sewage itself. Most of it is liquid. Anyway, the Glasgow Sludge Fleet was unique in as much as their ships carried passengers.
Right, and that must have been quite stinky for the passengers. Did they do it at the same time as carrying the sludge?
It was, but you see, this is where Glasgow was probably streets ahead of any of the other big cities, because it was using a public asset for the public good.
Okay.
And the social history here is that and it started off before the First World War, occasionally, where they would invite the poorest people of Glasgow who couldn't afford days out of any sort to come on board the ship. And this was typically done by the local councillor. And they would be invited on board the ship and basically taken for a trip down the river.
Nice.
Or down the water, as they used to say.
Was that while the ship was working? I mean, did they come on?
Yes.
Okay, right. So they go down the Clyde, they go out to sea, they drop the sewage, and then they get to go back again.
Yes, and typically they would come on board after the loading had completed, because I was told that that's actually quite a smelly process. And then they'd have a day on the ship, because it was about a four-hour trip down the river, and obviously the same going back. They did, I think it might have been after the First World War, they did actually provide lunch.
Right. If anyone could stomach
certainly on the second Shield Hall they did, and they take them inside whilst the cargo is being dropped.
Right. Okay, so there's actual human sewage, and then there's a cargo of impoverished, disadvantaged families. Yeah. I also read that there was sometimes space for wounded or disabled servicemen as well.
Yes, and that's really where I think that's where the tradition took off, if you like, that during the First World War, then Glasgow used to take on the, as you say, the wounded and the returning soldiers, but particularly the wounded soldiers from the First World War. They were made, I wouldn't say they were made a fuss of, but they were looked after in a way, as I say, that Glasgow did, that none of the other towns or cities even considered, as far as we know.
Yeah. It's a bit of a great piece of... I was going to say, it's a bit of a backhanded gift, isn't it? You get to go out on the ship, but it's going to reek. Or do you reckon people didn't think about it like that? They were just delighted
to go out? Because once you were on board, everything was closed down, so you basically left the smell behind.
Ah.
And as I say, it was a great day out by all occurrences. As I say, it's the city of Glasgow using its public asset for the public good.
Yeah. Are there any good letters and accounts of people's on their day out?
No, there's there's one thing that I heard on Radio Clyde some years ago. It's a little anecdote. I can't repeat the Glasgow accent.
No, that's okay.
Basically, you need a Glaswegian to tell you this, but the one of the crew, and it was a fine sunny day. Now, you've got to understand that your lunch, if you took your lunch as a sandwich, it was known as your piece.
Right.
And so there's this crewman, we'll call him Jimmy, because a lot of them are called Jimmy. And he came home from his work one day, and it had been a lovely, hot, sunny day, which may be quite unusual. And he goes back into his flat, and his wife says, "Jimmy, you stink. What on earth's going on?" "Ach," he said, "but Jacob, I dropped it in the water." And he said, she said, "Well, why does it smell?" He said, "Well, I dropped it in the water while they were dropping the cargo." She said, "Well, you said I left it where it is." "Ach, no, no," he said, "it had my piece in it."
Oh, wow.
So that's one little anecdote. As I say, it was on Radio Clyde, and whether it's true or not, we don't know. But, it's one of these things that the ship really had a trouble-free life. She had a minor collision with a ship on the Clyde, which is not surprising. And I think that was in the 1960s, a Blue Star ship. But apart from that, nothing really to speak of. As I say, it's typical of the majority of the merchant fleet of the world that nothing really exciting happened. They just did their daily toil. picking up cargo, taking it from point A to point B and dropping it off.
Yeah. And she then left Glasgow and then came down to Southampton and did a similar job, yeah?
Yeah, so she took about 20-odd years in Glasgow, and then the cost of fuel and really also the cost of crew, because she took a crew of 11 people, which for a ship of just 260-odd feet long is actually quite a large crew. So they laid her up, and one of the diesel ships, the Garrick Head, actually took over from her. And so Southern Water bought the ship and brought her south, laid her up actually for 3 years because there was an existing contract underway. And it's quite interesting that Southern Water obviously saw a great opportunity because when the ship was built, it cost all told about £280,000. And when Southern Water bought it 20 years later, they paid, I think it was £50,000. And then they, as I say, laid it up for 3 years because the ship was, there was another ship that was actually doing the run, which was under contract. Southern Water took it over, as I say, ran it for about 5 years, and again, the cost of crewing and fuel took its toll, and in 1985, she was laid up again.
Yeah. I mean, we should say now, I mean, this is the fairly unremarkable history of the ship. I mean, she's a fairly a standard merchant ship. She's carrying sewage around. There's some nice social history of her taking out these impoverished and working class people up in Glasgow. But the key thing about her is that even though she was built in the 20th century, is that she has the most remarkable, it's like she's like a time capsule. She's got all of the machinery on board is from a completely different era.
Yes, I mean, you can trace the design of the machinery, that's the boilers and the triple expansion, right the way back to the late 1800s.
Yeah.
And it really, if you look at your industrial heritage history, then it all sort of came, the technical advance came about because of the changes of the way that materials were becoming more, more successful. So iron was being replaced with steel. The steel quality was becoming more something that you could trust more. So you could actually roll steel where perhaps you couldn't roll iron. You could put higher pressures in the boilers and so on and so forth. And yeah. So what started off as a single cylinder or a single cycle steam engine, like railway locomotives, for instance, they then introduced compounding, which was to use the what would be the waste steam or the exhaust steam, which still had pressure in it, to use it in the second stage. And then, of course, as the pressures went up, then you could use it in a third stage, and hence what we call triple expansion.
But the effective, what's fascinating here is that the machinery, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but it's essentially obsolete, isn't it, at the time that
Absolutely.
She was launched? So do we know why that happened? Why did they build this ship with machinery which was so out of date and old?
Well, I think there was two factors. As I say, she was originally conceived back in 1950, and open crankcase triple expansion steam engine is one of the three factors that they wished to have on board. We think, or we can speculate, that was because the previous ships, the Shieldhall 1 and what would be its running mate, the Dalmarnock, were also triple expansion.
Okay.
And so the idea was you could take the engineering staff, the technical people, straight off one ship, put her on the second ship, and away you go without any retraining or anything like that. That was one aspect. The other aspect, that the diesels were a lot more expensive. And also you had a lot of restrictions just after the Second World War about how you could spend money. So unless you had the technology in the country, and if you had to import it, for instance, there was a lot of restrictions on where you could spend money. So all of that, we think, led them to say, right, well, we'll just go with what we've got and just basically update it.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Bit. Yeah, so the joy of this vessel is that she built in the 1950s, but actually the gear on board, the machinery, is typical of cargo and passenger ships going back to the 1870s.
Absolutely right. And in fact, she wasn't the last, because right up until the 1960, there was still one or two colliers being built for the what would be the coal boards. They still had triple expansion steam engines.
Yeah.
So, and there was a group of ferries built for the Bosphorus by Denny's around about that sort of 1960s time as well. So you can understand it was cheap technology, sort of cheap to build, probably fairly cheap to operate, but probably not the most efficient. So when fuel was cheap, that was the ideal.
Yeah, and as I said, we're going to talk about the engine in a minute, but I also read here that there are 20 steam engines driving all of the original machinery. That's mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of them, except for the two main engines, are what we call auxiliaries, Sam. Okay. So you've got various pumps, all to do with the life support system, as you might call it. So there's pumps for cooling water, there's pumps for feed water for the boiler, there's fuel pumps, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, okay. Well, and also, I mean, there's the stuff on deck. Her deck's made of teak, aren't they? Which does seem quite extraordinary, because it's so expensive, surely, to actually have the teak being imported. Did it come from India? Do we know where it came from?
Don't know where it came from, but you see, back then, that's what decks of ships were. They were teak. And it probably came from, I'll use the expression colonies, because it would either come from, I guess, India, Burma, somewhere like that, probably the Middle East, Far East. And it would have been probably held in store, because that sort of stuff, if you go down the Clyde, there used to be huge, great timber ponds between like the Erskine area and Port Glasgow, where there is huge timber ponds. Where timber like that would just be left to weather, and then they take it up and cut it into size,
and then it's almost impervious to rot when they actually kind of put it on. It's a magnificent material, isn't it?
It is, and the forecastle and the boat deck and what we call the bridge deck back aft, the docking bridge deck, are all teak. And as you say, this is really one of the remarkable things about the ship, that how typical it is of the 1950s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other aspect, of course, is the fact the ship is part riveted and part welded construction.
Right.
And really shows the transition in the British shipbuilding industry from one old technology to the new technology.
Yeah. So it almost like it happened in the middle of them building it, or they couldn't decide which one to do with the old technology or the new technology. So there's a bit of both, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, there might be some social history here. We don't really know, but suspect that the people that are doing the riveting were probably part of the Boilermakers Union, I suspect, Boilermakers and Platers. So they would have quite a large say in how much work effectively came their way. Because back then, welders, I always say if I'm giving a talk, welders by then were not considered to be a profession or whatever. They were more of a disease. And they would be looked upon as second-class, semi-skilled workers, whereas nowadays they are a real skilled work. And it's strange how you look at the social aspects of this, and you've got this internecine warfare between the unions. The funnel, for instance, that's riveted. It could have been welded. Why? It could have been that the boilermakers were looking for work. We don't know.
Yeah, it would be lovely to find that out. Now, let's talk about the wonderful engines and the boilers, because when I first spoke to you about that, you said, just not many people know this, but it's just like Titanic, but in miniature, which I loved. Yes. And yes. Because of that, we've made a little animation of the really wonderful engines of the Shield Hall. You can find them on our YouTube channel. That's the Mariner's Mirror Pod YouTube. And do please check those out. We'll put them up on social media as well, on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter for you to have a look at. But it's a wonderful animation. And if you get lost at all in this little discussion of boilers, then please just go and check that out. So boilers, woohoo! You might think this is a potentially dull subject, but let me reassure you it is not. I have become an expert in how boilers work over the last few weeks, making this animation work. So, take me through the boilers, Con.
Right, they're what they call Scotch-type boilers, and that's, again, that's a Scotch with a small S, not a capital S, so it's not because it's come from Scotland. It's the type of boiler. It's what they call a two-pass boiler, and it's a fire tube, so the water is on the outside of the tubes. And in our boilers, each boiler contains approximately 22 tonnes of water.
Right.
And that's fresh water. It is treated to reduce the various solids and so on and so forth. So what you have is a furnace at the bottom, and the furnace is a corrugated tube. The corrugation is there for strength and also to increase the heating area that is available.
Okay.
Now,
get that, yeah.
In our case, it's oil-fired, but it could just easily have been coal-fired. So you could have a big grate that ran the length of the furnace tube. So you put your fuel in, set fire to it, and it goes up to the back of the boiler and then does a complete U-turn and comes back through literally hundreds of smaller tubes.
Yeah, there are 320, I saw. There are 320 fire tubes. So these are tubes which are inside the boiler. So the water's sort of all around those tubes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, what you're trying to do, Sam, is to increase the amount of surface area of heat transfer. So the more tubes you have, obviously, the greater the surface area to transfer the heat from the gas into the liquid, into the fluid, water in this case, and then boil it off and collect the steam at the top of the boiler.
How big are these boilers? Give people a sense of size.
They're almost known as a square boiler, so they're about 11 feet long.
Yeah.
And a similar sort of diameter.
Okay.
So that relates to, just trying to think, just less than 3 meters, I guess, 2.5 meters.
Yeah. It's like a small car, perhaps, or a small van. Is that about right? Yeah, something like that. So, and how much water did they hold?
So about 25 tons is typical. Now, just to give you some idea of the size of the tube, the fire tube, the furnace tube, it's one of the things that I have to get in every year and inspect. So I can crawl in there across the shoulders. So I'm about, I guess a metre across the shoulders. There's room for me to wriggle in quite nicely and go up the back end and stand up at the back of the boiler.
Wow.
The tubes are typically, inch, so let's say 30-odd millimetres diameter. And various thicknesses of wall thickness, depending on the tube, is what they call a stay tube, which is supporting each of the tube plates at each end, or whether it's just there for purely for heat transfer.
Yeah. Okay, so the water is boiled by the heat in the fire tubes.
Yes.
And then what happens?
Right, so then what happens is the gas then goes through 90 degrees upwards through some more tubes, which is actually heating the air that's coming in for combustion. So you're trying to extract the maximum amount of waste heat to reduce the amount of thermal shock, if I can use that expression, of the air going in. So you preheat the air before it's used in the furnace for firing purposes. And then once it's gone through those tubes, the exhaust goes up the funnel and out to atmosphere.
Yeah.
So you're actually heating the water to, preheating the air to a temperature of, we did measure it once, I'm just trying to, I can't remember what it is offhand now. So as I say, you're preheating the air before it goes into the furnace.
Right. And then you have the triple expansion bit.
Yes.
Let's explain that.
So what's the best way? So once you've captured the steam at the top of the boiler, then it goes through a collector in the boiler onto the main steam valve. That then goes to the throttle valve on each engine. So each engine has its own throttle valve. And it is, as the name implies, an open-closed, and it's not, you can graduate it so you can make the engine go faster or slower. You introduce the steam into the high pressure cylinder, and that's a relative term. And the maximum, that if the steam valve is fully open, the throttle valve is still fully open, you can get full boiler pressure acting on what we call the high pressure steam cylinder. Once the work is done in that cylinder, it is then exhausted through the valves into the next stage, because in doing work, you've actually dropped the pressure from, let's say, 100 psi down to approximately 25. And I'm just using some psi terms here at the moment.
But the key point is there's still enough pressure for that steam to be useful.
Absolutely. And this is where the Victorians, I think, were great engineers, because they spotted that this was energy that would otherwise be wasted.
Yep.
So it goes into the second stage, and the second stage cylinder is larger than the first stage, because what you're trying to do is to work the same amount of force. And this is where you have to go back to some basic physics, that the pressure over the area will give you a downward force. And what you're trying to do is to make sure that each cylinder has a similar amount of force.
Yeah.
So what then goes into the second stage, and from the second stage, there's still a little bit of energy left. So what might have been 25 pounds per square inch going in might only be sort of 5 or 6 pounds per square inch coming out. That then gets exhausted into the low pressure cylinder. And as I say, the low pressure cylinder is the largest one of the lot. Yeah. So again, reduced pressure, large area, but hopefully the same force. And the whole idea is that by the time it's finished in that part of the engine, there is no wasted energy. And then we have what we call an air extraction pump, which creates a vacuum which draws that waste steam away into the condenser. The steam is then condensed back to water and then fed back into the boiler. That's very simplistically how it works.
Yeah.
So that's the triple expansion engine, as I say. It is, as the name implies, three stages by expansion.
Yeah, it's beautifully described as well. But they're essentially recycling the steam, aren't they? Or they're using it for one purpose, then they realise there's still enough energy in it, and then using it again, and then using it again until there's nothing left.
That's right. And a lot of people can relate to railway locomotives, where they do what they call linking up. So they use the expansive capacity of the steam within a simple cylinder arrangement, whereas we use the expansion of the steam through the engine to get the maximum work out of it.
Yeah. Clever stuff. And how much speed does that generate? I mean, this whole engine, how fast can the ship go?
Well, on trials, she managed just over 13 knots, and we believe that was probably the first and only time, unless the captain was in a hurry to go home for his dinner. But typically, service speed would be 10 or 11 knots. We run it around about 8 or 9 knots, and that's really for fuel efficiency from our point of view, because it costs in around, if we're doing a 8 or 9 knots, we're burning something like 0.6 tonnes yeah. an hour. And fuel today is around about £350 a tonne. So you can start to work out how expensive that is.
Yeah. Really gets right? going,
so,
doesn't it?
Yeah, and on a diesel ship, it would be a lot less than that. So you would, whereas we'd be using 0.6, they'd probably be using 0.15, 0.2 tonnes an hour for a similar size engine. The engines, by the way, are 800 horsepower each.
Wow.
Okay.
Extraordinary stuff. What about the steering engine? Because that's, is that steam as well?
Yes. Yeah, that's one of our 20 steam engines. And that's a little two-cylinder engine, what we call fixed lap and lead, because as they turn the wheel on the bridge, it sends a hydraulic signal right the way back aft. And again, this is another connection with the Titanic, because she had a very similar steering gear, we are told. Again, it's just a matter of scale. The hydraulic signal goes back aft. The hydraulic medium is a mixture of glycol and water, and it goes to a hydraulic cylinder, which opens or closes a valve, which determines whether the engine goes one way or the other. And whichever way it is, it then drives the rudder quadrant over to port or to starboard, and obviously turns the rudder as well. So it's a very, very straightforward system. Again, that's a system that was in service probably for, I would say, getting on for 80 or 90 years. And it's like anything in the marine industry, things were done by evolution rather than revolution.
Yeah.
Very, very simple engine. As I say, a little two-cylinder engine.
Yeah. And there's what about the technique of passing messages to the engine room? How did that happen?
That's by telegraph. And this is where you see the classic films, the ding, 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 ding. Pull ahead, right. Captain.
Yeah.
Or mere steam MacPhail if you're on if you're para handy.
Yeah.
But this is a very simple system, and it's all done by chains, rods, and springs. So it's a mechanical system that goes from the bridge right the way down to the engine room, and when at the engine room side, when the bridge rings one way or the other, every time it passes one of the orders, it goes a ding, 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 ding. And we reply with our handle, which is a reply handle, which gives them a ring back up on the bridge to let them know that we've received the order.
Nice. And that is basically how that's what the British Empire worked on, a bit of dinging and a bit of telegraph systems. That's how it all got put together.
Yeah, and it's a very simple, very straightforward. It was replaced by electric systems and all sorts of stuff. Nowadays, of course, you have bridge control, so that would all be bypassed completely.
Yeah. Well, how would people find out more? Can they come and have a trip?
Yes. We're in our website, which is www.ss-shieldhall.co.uk. Has the details. You can book online, and we've got a program ready to go. We are taking bookings at the moment. We're looking at, we're looking at starting this summer. That's because we had a complete summer out last year through COVID-19. But we are really hoping that people will have an energy and a desire to come aboard this year, so that we can actually recover some of the lost finances that we had last year. Yeah. But when you're on board, the engine room and the bridge are open by invitation. So you will hear a public address saying that the engine room and bridge are open for visitors. And we welcome you. We will explain what's going on. We will actually get people into the boiler room as well if they want to. It's a wee bit warmer in there. It's 40 degrees plus centigrade, so no need to go cold on a steamship, as we say. And similarly on the bridge, you can go up and see the master in control of the ship, and with traditional charts as well as modern day radar systems as well. All the things that you would have had on a traditional ship, but also all the things that we need these days to carry passengers safely as well.
Yeah. I think the key word here is it's a time capsule. It's amazing. Seeing all the traditional instruments, the gleaming brasswork, everything you'd expect for a steamship. I'd urge you all to go and have a look. And while you're waiting, do please go and check out the little animation of the boilers and the engine. And remember, it's like Titanic, but in miniature. It's a wonderful thing. And thank you all very much for listening. And Graham, thank you for talking to us today.
That's a pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
But that's it for this week. I very much hope that you've enjoyed yourselves. Please do follow us on social media. You can follow the Society for Nautical Research at Nautical History on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. The Mariner's Mirror has got its own Instagram page and YouTube channel, and there's going to be some fascinating material being posted on both in the coming weeks. What else can you do? Well, please do join the Society for Nautical Research. You can find us at snr.org.uk, and your subscription fee will go towards publishing the most important naval and maritime history and to preserving the world's maritime heritage. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.